All right, welcome back to the Spotlight series here with Middletech. Today we're with Jane Morris, and we've spoken to you in the past. We're looking forward to getting an update on everything that you've been accomplishing, challenges you're facing, and learnings we can take away from that just for our audience's sake. So thanks for joining us.
Oh my gosh, thank y'all for having me back. I'm so excited to see you guys.
And yeah, you've had all sorts of awesome updates in the news too, so we're excited to touch on some of the things that have been going on at To the Market. But let's just start by doing a quick recap on what To the Market is, just for our listeners who might not have listened to the first episode or, you know, might need a refresher. Tell us a little bit about what the goal of To the Market is.
Yeah. So To the Market, we are a supply chain software. We focus on enabling responsible vendor compliance and management, digitized procurement, automated impact reporting. So in like laypeople terms, we're helping to power the ethical and sustainable supply chain.
All right. So ethical supply chain. Let's dive into that a bit, because I think everybody's familiar with, I think, supply chain, you know, logistics on how we get packages around the world, how we get goods to our refrigerator. You know, I think people can have an image of that. But give us an idea of the difference between just everyday logistics and what, you know, ethical supply chain looks like.
Yeah. I mean, supply chains are pervasive. They allow us to get access to most of the things that we all enjoy today, whereas in the past, we had, you know, very, quote, short supply chains, right? Like we grew what we ate. Maybe we went and bartered in the market or paid for things in the market. Now, of course, we get access to product from all over the world. Sometimes that's been made, grown, created in a very short period of time and delivered it in a very short period of time. So lots of different opportunity in supply chain tech. We in particular have been focused from the beginning on connecting what we believe to be more ethical, more sustainable, i.e. lower risk, more compliant factories with businesses that are seeking sourcing and production activity. So we're really focused not on sort of what people would call last mile. We're not direct to consumer, where we're working with, you know, someone from a distribution center to a customer. We are focused on the production of a product at a factory and then having that product move to a to an end client here in the US, so B2B. What is ethical and sustainable? It is a factory that your company can feel good about using, meaning that you feel confident that there is a lower likelihood that that factory is engaging in behavior that you would be embarrassed about if it was on the front page of the New York Times. So child labor, forced labor, dumping chemicals into you know, water streams. Oftentimes people think ethical and sustainable, we must be talking about, you know, a fair trade factory or a factory who, you know, is running its business on rainwater or, you know, solar power. And that's awesome when they're at that level of progression. But a lot of times what we're really looking at is making sure someone is at the very least compliant, i.e. table stakes, operating legally that a company can feel good about, and then giving them enough data associated with the factories to help them understand what's the difference between a good factory, what's the difference between a good and a better factory, and what does best look like?
Yeah, I think one thing that I've noticed as I've grown up, because, you know, being 27, I've kind of seen how the demand for ethical and sustainable goods has increased. And I think the first good I can remember really blowing up was, you know, Tom's Shoes. Mm-hmm. What do you think is driving the demand for ethical and sustainable supply chain? Is it we've got more media, we've got more transparency into more of the world because of social media and just in general content? And now we're able to see how other people around the world live, and we don't want our goods to maybe come from. Is that what's driving it, you think, media, or what are you seeing?
No, I mean, you know, Tom's definitely was one of the first movers as it relates to sort of thinking that conscious consumerism can be cool, right? Like it doesn't have to be like a church fair, like jewelry that you buy like as a pity purchase. And I think it was one of the first examples of looking at conscious consumerism at mass. The space has evolved dramatically. As you know, oftentimes spaces that are evolving do, right? You cross a chasm and you come into a place where things begin to iterate and innovate very, very rapidly. So what's driving that rapid innovation? Three primary points of pressure on businesses to improve the way they operate. First is consumer pressure, which of course Tom's, you know, was very responsive to, where you have a generation of buyers. You have a millennial and a Gen Z generation, which collectively represent the most purchasing power in history. And like every generation, they have different attributes that are important to them, right? So we think of sort of the greatest generation as being sort of very focused on price consciousness. Like they really value feeling like they're getting a good deal. And these are, of course, mass generalizations, but looking at like Nielsen data, you look at Gen X. Gen X paid a lot of value to brands. Like this is BMW, this is Coach, this is Chanel. That is valuable, right? It represents good to them. Millennials and Gen Z are a little different. They put a prioritization among many things on things like sustainability. That's important to them. So as companies think about attracting and retaining that customer, as well as that potential employee, they're thinking about sustainability. They're thinking about social compliance. So that's sort of one piece of pressure. Second piece of pressure is investor pressure. So you look at LPs that started, you know, putting pressure on allocators. At first, it sort of was in the carbon space, right? Like, don't be in fossil fuels or don't be in this or that. And, you know, I'm not passing judgment on whether, you know, whether that it was like the right sort of approach or whether that was an effective approach. But what I think the sort of theme that is worthwhile to me, regardless of whether you agree and like say no to this type of investment versus that type of investment, is that you want as an investor to be trying to de-risk the company that you are investing in as much as possible. And if you recognize that supply chain, it represents a risk, then you would be encouraging your C-suite to take steps that are commercially viable to help them de-risk their operations. So that's a second point of pressure. So we have consumer, we have investor pressure. Third point of pressure is one that's changed pretty dramatically, even in the last 18 months, maybe even in the last 12 months since I saw y'all, you know, on the recording. And that's regulation. And again, like I'm not making statement for or against. Our job is to track and then help support our clients be compliant. And so we've seen quite dramatic increases in regulation, both in the United States as well as abroad, that is impacting U.S. domiciled businesses that are related to supply chain transparency. And so companies, in order to feel like they're not going to have hundreds of millions of dollars of products stuck at U.S. customs because it was potentially made with forced labor in China, or be able to sell into an EU market because, you know, that's a huge opportunity for them outside of the U.S. market, they are making changes in their supply chain, and we're helping them do that.
And talk about what this looked like prior to the market coming onto the scene in the first place. So how were companies gaining any sort of visibility or transparency into this process in the first place? Or how are they even able to identify the way that their supply chain was sourcing all of these goods and products?
Yeah, I mean, supply chains are notoriously analog and opaque. So like if we look at the U.S. market, and obviously I know you all have listeners from all over the world, but like if we look at the U.S. market, when we normalized relations with China, got really obsessed with low cost manufacturing. And, you know, in some respects, you can make an argument that that was like hugely helpful in the affordability of product. In other respects, you could point to it as a big decline in manufacturing capabilities here in the United States. So when we became quite reliant on Chinese-based manufacturing, one of the sort of secondary outputs of that is that we relied on mostly mainland China-based retail brokers to allocate factories on our behalf. So the workflow would be, I'm Jane, I work at TJ Maxx, I want to have a t-shirt made. I say to Evan, who works in, you know, who is in mainland China, hey, this is the t-shirt I want to have made. And he goes and has the t-shirt made for me at a factory that he trusts that is going to execute on costing and on quality. And I am going to typically not ask questions about like, well, who's the factory? How is it being made? Do we feel good about, you know, that process? That's a very new thing that I would ask those types of questions, because there is a different generation now of people who seek additional information because they're not used to having opacity in anything that they do. But you also have this sort of broader regulatory environment. So all of that to say, you know, what's the difference between the past and the present? You know, the difference is that now we have technology that allows us to have more digitized workflows. Now we have technology that allows us to better understand the footprint of a factory who may be making a product that we rely on to run our business. And there is a very different expectation within supply chains to understand who your factory is than there was even 5 years ago.
So last time we spoke was a little year ago, I believe. And catch us up on, you know, some of the exciting things that are going on growth-wise for you. So made the Inc. 5000 list again. You have an exciting product line with Kohl's. You are putting out amazing reports on progress on, you know, sustainability and ethics. And so touch on some of your favorite things that have happened maybe since last we spoke.
Well, look, you know, with every business, it's like the iceberg, right? You have like amazing things that people see, and there's like 30,000 things that people don't see. So, great successes this year. Lots and lots of challenges, like any business. So, successes that I'm proud of. We brought on an amazing CFO, a gentleman who had been at two very public sort of PE VC-backed businesses in retail technology, Latote and Credo Beauty, also been at places like Old Navy, brought him on as a CFO, which was a huge win for us. I wouldn't have been able to get that done if one of our investors who was the CEO of Credo Beauty hadn't recommended him because he was the CFO to her. So super pumped about, you know, bringing on that type of talent. Also was able to convince one of our board directors, who was a former VP of innovation, to come in fractionally and help us build out some of our SaaS. And again, huge win in the sense that he's just such an incredible mind, such an incredible talent that I'm just so fortunate that we're able to work with him and have, you know, more of his mind share on a day-to-day basis. On like the press side, you know, it's always awesome when you get, you know, get recognition. We did make Inc. For a second time, Inc. 5000 fastest growing private companies. We got honored by Fast Company. Our ethical supply chain software was a Fast Company Innovation by Design honoree. That was awesome. I got an award in Women's Wear Daily, which is like cool. But like never thought in a million years I would ever get Women's Wear Daily acknowledgement, because I feel like we're so like B2B and so sort of behind the scenes. But they named me one of the most influential ESG leaders in retail. Whether you like ESG or you hate its guts, still was like a nice acknowledgement. Didn't apply for it. Like was super pumped that like I ended up being named it. So that was very cool. We had another award by Meaningful Business that sort of was acknowledging the work of To the Market and the difference that we're making in the industry. So awesome, like press, super pumped about talent, you know, and then with that, like X times 1,000 challenges that every entrepreneur exists. Yeah.
Well, let's dive into, you know, as always, like you said, so many challenges. Maybe if you could pick one that you want to communicate to the audience on the challenge and then the learning on how you got through it, so the audience can maybe come away with how they would face it when they come up to it.
Yeah, I mean, so I think one of the biggest challenges we had this year is we had a client who is a large business, very creditworthy business, who did not pay us over $700,000 of an invoice for an extended period of time, and in fact, still haven't fully paid that invoice. And what that did is it had sort of a trickle effect within our cash flow. You know, when you're sort of suddenly have a 700K hole, it just creates a serious domino effect. It impacted, you know, our factoring partnerships. So these are folks who will come in and factor purchase orders or their factor invoices that helps allow us to source and manufacture without utilizing balance sheet capital. It had a big impact on them, where they were like, hey, we can't keep doing business unless this gets cleared. So suddenly you have those two levers turned off. So What did that teach me? I mean, a million things, not the least of which is, as a leader, and you could be a leader in a part of a business and a part of a nonprofit. You could be a nonprofit leader. You could be the head of a household or co-head of a household. There will be times where you have capital scarcity that you did not plan for. And the question then becomes, what will you do about the unplanned capital scarcity? There are sacrifices or trade-offs that inevitably you will have to make. There is no sort of world in which, oh, I can make it all work even though I have, you know, like a significant hole in what I thought I would have. It means that not everything is going to be able to get done that you want to get done. It means that people that you need to pay are not going to be able to be paid in the timing that you thought. And I've had to have a lot of those conversations this year, talking to suppliers, talking to service providers, negotiating terms, and it's deeply uncomfortable, but you also have to remind yourself that this is business. This is like business is business. It's not personal. And unfortunately, like the longer you're out sort of in the workforce, again, whether this happens to you on the personal side, you have an unexpected layoff, you have an unexpected sort of salary, whatever, or the professional side, like that there are times where you're going to have to look at your expenses and look at your plans and be like, this is going to have to change pretty significantly for me to respond to something that is fundamentally not my fault.
Before highlighting our sponsors, we'd just like to state that the views and content shared on this platform do not necessarily reflect those of our show sponsors. Middletech is presented by KY Innovation, the Kentucky Cabinet for Economic Development's Office of Entrepreneurship. KY Innovation exists to support and develop Kentucky's startup ecosystem, and we are proud to be supported by an organization whose mission aligns so closely with ours. If you're a founder building in Kentucky, you need to check out the resources that KY Innovation has to offer. You can find more information by clicking the link in our show notes or going to kyinnovation.com. Middletech is sponsored by Bolt Marketing. Take your website to the next level with a website that's built to work. At Bolt Marketing, they're revolutionizing websites for small businesses that are affordable, customizable, and hassle-free. Whether you have a construction company, a boutique clothing store, or you own a hot yoga studio, they have options for you. Click the link in our show notes to explore their marketing options that can transform your marketing and grow your business. And as a personal note, Bolt Marketing built our website, and they were awesome to work with throughout the entire process. We highly recommend working with them.
And I feel like this was the past, since we've talked, really has been such an interesting time for business owners with like the fluctuations in interest rates and like all these different things kind of going on in the financial world. And so I think that's really relevant to talk about having to deal with just changes in the way that your finances are kind of operating. I know obviously that's one that's obvious, is as much out of your control as anything else. But talk about, you know, what you guys are kind of focusing on going into the future now. So you've kind of made it through that really big challenge there and had some learnings from it. But what are you guys focusing on over the next, you know, 2 to 3 years with To The Market?
Yeah. So we signed a term sheet and then long docs with an institutional investor to raise another round of capital. The stipulation of us sort of doing this additional round of capital is taking some of the features on our software platform, externalizing, monetizing them to create a SaaS opportunity. So, just sort of to recap, how does To The Market make money? We launched our business with a enterprise marketplace, i.e. someone like TJ Maxx, who was not the person who didn't pay, to be clear, would say like, hey, like we need a t-shirt factory, you know, real case scenario. I need a t-shirt factory. They can utilize our software to find a vetted and monitored supplier that makes t-shirts. They can digitally procure through that factory to get those t-shirts made. They can get data on the impact of the t-shirts that they have made so they can go take credit for that better procurement decision. That's on a transaction basis, right? Like so many enterprise marketplaces or marketplaces period, it's transaction based revenue. What we realized is that someone like a TJ Maxx would also benefit from onboarding their non-To The Market factories onto our platform to be vetted and monitored by our software and be managed by our software. Because right now, what we've gone to market with is when you don't have a factory, come to us. We're a de-risk supply chain. But what we've realized is that some of the features that we built on the software could be very much so utilized to vet and monitor their existing factories, therefore revealing when they have risky factories that may then encourage them to do more business with us on the marketplace side. So that is a big push for us in 24. It's why we brought in, our one of our board directors to help sort of fractionally lead the development of that SaaS, and has been, you know, what I've been fundraising around over the last couple of months.
Yeah, and that kind of changes the whole business dynamic when you think of it from a SaaS revenue perspective and the enterprise value of the business. So I'm sure that kind of plays into the whole strategic planning of, you know, looking at the financial future of To The Market as well. And touch real briefly on your fundraising process. So you mentioned you've kind of been hitting the ground hard with that. I think it's just always interesting to hear founders' perspectives on the challenges that come with that and making it a little bit more realistic to like how much of a grind it truly is, because I feel like it's still a little bit romanticized if you've never done it before. So just talk about your experience like fundraising and what the reality of that has been for you.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I love... It is, I want to say that fundraising for, I would say 99% of entrepreneurs is deeply misunderstood. And I think it's misunderstood not by the entrepreneurs themselves, but by the general public. And I think it's misunderstood largely because people read about what they think the process will be. They think that the process will be they'll go to market with like a CRM of targeted investors. They'll have an amount that they want to raise. They will get multiple term sheets that they will then negotiate. They will then work on, you know, allocating the remaining space. It will be an oversubscribed round. They will close within a 60-day period and they will move on with their life. And the truth is that for all of the money I've raised to date, for all the money my husband raised to date, that probably happened to Nate. He raised, I don't know, $500 million. That probably happened in one round. For me, that's never happened. And I share that because I think it's so important for every entrepreneur who's out there who it doesn't look like that. What I hear so often when they haven't raised or been sort of in the market as long as I have is that they think they're bad at it or that they're a failure. And the truth is, that's so far from the truth. The truth is that they have been sold a process that's unfortunately generally unrealistic, especially in this market. And so what the process really looks like is it's a much longer process. You're in the market longer. You have to have a lot more conversations. There's a lot more top of the funnel to get you to your sort of end numbers. And, it is a long process that requires a high number of conversations. I remember when I think I told you all this story last year, but I'll repeat it for anyone who's sort of listening. I remember when, before I had ever raised money for To The Market, and I was thinking about doing a pre-seed round, and you know, we applied to Techstars and we got into Techstars and I was so excited. And I was thinking about, okay, like how big do I want to make this pre-seed round? And I remember Nate saying to me like, well, Jane, you know, you sort of need mentally in your mind to be thinking about 50 to 100 conversations, you know, outreach. Doesn't have to be like long conversations, but like targeted out emails. Someone introduces you to get to like one or two yeses. And I remember thinking like, Nate, you're so fantastical in your like descriptions of things, like this feels so exaggerated. And he was absolutely right. And so oftentimes what I say to other founders, especially non-traditional founders that perhaps, you know, have to work even harder to raise money, that like, it's not that you're not good at it. You're just not talking to enough people.
Yeah. I'm recovering from fundraising right now. I've been slowly trying to just distance myself from that experience over the last several months, having gone through a pre-seed round and then failing to do a seed round and having to exit and, you know, give money back to investors. So I'm recovering from that. And so a few things that, you know, I took away from, you know, that experience is I feel like most of your money is going to come from warm intros. So focus on finding people that like what you're doing, whether or not they want to invest or not. Always ask them, hey, who else is interested in this? I always found that the best velocity I had in my rounds came from excitement of warm intros. So focus on those. I think, like you said, many founders go into it with like a CRM or a spreadsheet and they think, I'm going to reach out to all these people cold. I'm going to go on the website and put my deck into their form and fill out their form. And I mean, the odds of them picking you are, I don't even know. It's not even 1 in 100. It's not even 1%.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, totally.
And typically, you know, I think when I raised my pre-seed round, I probably talked about 120 and maybe 15 of them invested. So there's that, you know, percentage to keep in mind. So yeah, it's very hard. It's a grind. But my advice is always just to kind of focus on warm intros. And if that means not officially going out and raising your round and just networking first and just saying, hey, here's what I'm working on. What are you working on? And just trying to meet more people so that when it does come time to raise, you've got kind of a built up warm intro, kind of, pent up demand there.
Totally.
That's one thing that I think I would advise people on.
I love that. I think that's so smart. And then like for folks who are like, well, like I don't have anyone to talk to, I think that's where organizations are so important. So like one could say like I'm incredibly fortunate person in that I have a lot of friends. I have, you know, been in circles that have a lot of influence. And someone could say on the surface, like, you know, how easy for you to go out and fundraise. And I would, you know, respond like, yes, I am more fortunate than most that I've had access to those circles. And I found at the beginning of my fundraising process that my circles were actually very strong, but in different places, i.e. because I had started and as you guys know, I started at the State Department. I was in counterterrorism. My family's worked in government. I had, you know, circles that were valuable, but they weren't valuable in the right places, right? Like they weren't sort of, you know, investor-y type circles. And so what that meant is that I needed to forge new circles and doing things like Techstars. You know, I got a fellowship at this group called Unreasonable Group, which is a community of people that run programs for sort of growth stage, you know, triple bottom line businesses. Things like that have been hugely, hugely valuable for me because while I had, you know, on the surface, like networks that I could tap into, a lot of times those weren't the right networks and I had to go out and forge new ones. And that's where I think things like accelerators, incubators, alumni events, community events are so, so, so helpful because you're able to tap into a network that might be something that wasn't personally available to you prior to, you know, getting involved in that organization.
Yeah. And to bring it back to Kentucky, the last bit of advice I would give was, you know, there's not as much capital here in Kentucky or investors that are willing to do high risk technology investments. And I think one of the mistakes I made when I first was raising was I kind of isolated the first people I talked to being in Kentucky. And what that does is it kind of constricts the market in which that you are fundraising and the money. And once you get to the coast and you see that money and you're like, holy cow, this is a totally different game. They move faster. They write larger checks. The terms are better. So my advice to founders here in Kentucky is to get to the coast as quick as you can, whether it's New York, Boston, Los Angeles, or San Francisco especially. Get there because the market is just so much bigger. And if you just talk to investors in Kentucky, your terms aren't going to be as good. You're not going to have as much capital opportunity there. And so you've got to get out of Kentucky. And I see founders over and over again struggle with getting to the coast, but you've got to figure out a way. It could just be one connection, which I happen to have. And it took me, I always love to tell the story, it took me about 6 to 8 months to raise 300K in Kentucky. And then it took me about 3 weeks to raise the other 300K of my pre-seed round on the coast. And so it's just exponential on the coast once you get there and up that market and get there as fast as you can.
Yeah. I mean, and I would say like for folks who are like, well, how the heck would I find anybody? I mean, I have friends that, you know, have literally gone and stayed with other friends, like camped out for weeks in some of those markets just to like network, show up to the events, get one coffee, which turns into another coffee. Like you don't have to be a part of, you know, Techstars in New York or Techstars in whatever, right? You can be a part of none of that, but have one place that you can stay, start showing up to free community events, you know, start asking people for coffee, asking for any ideas that they may have, feedback, advice, and let your community sort of roll from there.
Yeah, to illustrate that, I've told this story before on the podcast. I did that. I went to San Francisco, stayed with a friend for a while, networked and raised capital. And when I was out there, they did a wine night at their house. And it was right in the middle of San Francisco. And there were about 30 people there. And of the 30 people there, they had raised about 10x more than the entire state of Kentucky, just in that room. So the founders in that room raised about $150,000. And for the entire year, I think whatever year it was, that was two years ago, Kentucky had raised about a tenth of that total across entrepreneurs. So it's just the level of capital allocation that's happening there compared to here is not even comparable. Just in that one room, you know, think about that. So to end on a positive note, you know, I read through your report on the effect that you're having on the world when it comes to sustainability and ethics. I want you to pick out maybe one of your favorite one or two stats and why it's important to you and why you care so much about it and how you're making a difference. And then that'll be one of the last questions.
Yeah. So we do an impact report on an annual basis, and we do that because there is power in people's purchasing power. Like, the intent is for folks to realize that the decision to use one factory over a next could be minor to you, but monumental to the factory that you choose. Similarly, for those who, you know, are conservationists, environmentalists, however you describe yourself, what seemingly seems like a small decision, like, oh, I'm going to use organic cotton for my uniforms versus conventional cotton, can yield actually significant results as it relates to things like water, liters of water saved, or kilowatts of energy saved, or carbon emissions avoided, pesticides not utilized. It can be real. I love the environment. I love people even more. So I always get really excited about hours of fair wages that we create. And I love tracking the number of hours of fair wages that one can create through sort of purchases that are done with socially compliant factories. And so one of my favorite sort of deals from over the last year was, we had a very large financial institution that was bringing all of its staff back to the office and wanted to do a gift to all of them. And they utilized our supply chain platform to source that gift. And they were able to then read the impact that the order had, which was hundreds of thousands of units of a tech organizer. And it created, you know, hundreds of thousands of fair wage hours of work for people. And that is really, really impactful when you think about the opportunity to take a very broken industry and look for redemptive qualities, right? Like, you think about, how can I think about this industry in a way that I could begin to build a business that's not just ethical, it's actually redeeming. Like, it's redeeming on the earth. Like, it's redeeming from a sustainability standpoint. It's redeeming the brokenness in the way in which we employ other people. That to me is like so exciting, because it's market driven. Like, it's driven by the demand of what consumers or investors are seeking. And yet on the sort of supply side, the effect is that it's transformative for the people who are able to participate in those orders.
And I love hearing stories like that, because that really paints a picture of how you're impacting, like, you know, the entire world in different ways. And I just have so much admiration for people who are chasing after really like world-changing problems and trying to figure out a business solution to not only make it sustainable from like an environmental perspective, but also from an economics perspective. So just kudos to you for everything you're doing with To The Market. It's been a lot of fun to follow along all of the accomplishments you guys have had. I feel like I have to call it out just because it's kind of been funny to try and ignore. We have had so many flies on this episode. And it's just, this is going to be the fly episode. So thank you for being a rock star and just like not breaking stride yeah. the entire time. Before we let you go, Jane, if you can just give our audience where they can find To The Market, your social media, stuff like that, if they want to follow along with what you guys are doing.
Totally. So tothemarket.com, tovmarket.com. Most of our social handles are Let's Go TTM, Let's Go To The Market. Would love for folks to follow along on our journey. If we can ever be of help to anyone who's listening, whether that means helping them find ethical and sustainable factories or helping them vet and monitor factories that they're utilizing, we would love to partner with you.
Thank you all for tuning in. We hope you all enjoyed. Before signing off here, I just wanted to take a second to thank a lot of the people that make Middle Tech possible. So first off, I wanted to thank JP Blevins for letting us use his space to record. A big thank you to Jacob Spencer, our executive producer, and Lamaya Stearns for producing the episode and getting it out to all of you guys. And then a big thank you to TJ Barnett, Ethan Sharp, and Austin Short for producing all of our social content that goes out on our social channels. So just wanted to make sure that we're highlighting everyone that makes Middle Tech like possible. It takes a lot of work to do what we do. And I wanted to make sure that everyone that plays a role in that is recognized and appreciated.